This Global IQ is with Dr. Mark Lynch. Dr. Lynch is professor of political science and director of the Institute for Middle East Studies at George Washington University. I had the pleasure of talking with Dr. Lynch here in Norfolk, Virginia, where he was speaking to the World Affairs Council of Hampton Roads. This program was sponsored by the World Affairs Councils of America and also supported by a grant from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. I'm sure you'll enjoy our conversation, which could not have been more timely.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Global IQ Minute. You know, you are one of the most keen observers of what's happening in the Middle East, and one of the things that we hear so much is that if the United States had been engaged 2 years ago and had supported the rebels, that we wouldn't be in the situation we're in today. Do you buy into that?
I've never believed that. So there are a number of different ways that the U.S. could have gotten involved in Syria 2 years ago, and none of them necessarily or even likely lead to a better outcome than where we are right now. So we might have tried to support the rebels by giving them weapons and trying to turn them into the kind of effective force that could have overthrown Assad. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that this was always a very fragmented, very divided group of rebel organizations with different ideologies, different and rapidly shifting alliances. And the line between good guy rebels and groups that are practically, or in some cases like Jabhat al-Nusra, literally members of al-Qaeda, has always been very vague. And people move back and forth. They have shifting alliances. And so the idea that the U.S. could have easily identified groups that you would want to work with and who could deliver a better type of Syria and actually overthrow Assad was always unreasonable. They were getting money from the Gulf, from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia. They were getting support from Turkey. Different groups were. And so the United States wouldn't have been the only game in town, and they would have simply been competing with all of these different sources of external support. What would have happened if we had armed the rebels earlier is we might have shifted the balance within those groups and made some of the moderate groups a little bit stronger relative to the extremist groups, but it would only have been on the margins. I don't think it would have brought down Assad. Now, we could have gone in and created no-fly zones. We could have started bombing. We could have done things like we're doing right now. But even those would most likely have failed to dislodge Assad. I mean, look, this guy has been successfully fighting for the last 3 years.
And still with a very strong military.
Still has a very strong military, has a strong base of domestic support, people who are terrified of what they fear will happen if the rebels win. And so when you start talking about bombing campaigns like the one we're doing right now, what you're really looking at is the very likely prospect of rapid escalation. This didn't work. What do we do next? And that's what the president was afraid of at the time, of a slippery slope down to another Iraq-style quagmire. And I'm afraid that's where we are right now.
The situation today seems very different. It's September 25th, and there are preliminary reports that some of these rebel groups now are really joining under almost a unifying command, and that the United States and other coalition partners are supporting them. So has the situation changed among the rebel groups?
Not much. Actually, almost every significant rebel group has come out against the American bombing campaign. And the reason is that they're very upset that the United States is attacking ISIS and also some of the extremist non-ISIS rebel groups and not attacking Assad. Basically, the United States is asking them to stop fighting Assad and fight ISIS instead, and that's not what they want to do. They fundamentally disagree with that strategy. And so I think that some things have changed. So I think that the fear of ISIS has brought many of the external players, like the Qataris and the Saudis and the Turks, to be more on the same page. And I think they are trying to coordinate their support for the rebels now in ways that they haven't for the last 3 years. But I don't think fundamentally the situation has changed yet.
There's been a lot of questions about U.S. ground troops, boots on the ground. Can you envision a situation, first let me ask it this way, with the Saudis or the Qataris or anyone putting troops on the ground?
None of them really have the kind of ground forces that could make any difference.
So what you're really seeing is countries that have strong U.S.-trained backed air force.
Yeah, so the Saudis and the Emiratis can send some fighter jets in, and mostly for symbolic rather than practical purposes. What the United States wants out of its Gulf partners in these bombing campaigns is legitimacy. They want this to be seen as an Arab war, but they're not really doing the heavy lifting. You could imagine maybe a few Arab faces on a peacekeeping operation after Assad falls or something like that, but they're not going to be doing any kind of serious, heavy work in terms
of... You expect to see U.S. troops?
Well, you know, if things keep going the way they are now, it's hard to see how it's going to be avoided. We've already seen the introduction of troops back into Iraq. I know the president is determined to avoid it, but once you've begun bombing and it fails, then I don't see... It's going to be extremely difficult politically to resist the pressure to do just a little bit more, just a little bit more.
A slippery slope.
Very much a slippery slope. And if Assad actually does fall, that's even more going to be pressure for troops there to keep the peace. And you know, that's actually in some ways one of the worst case scenarios, because then you would be right back in an Iraq situation where you're supporting an unpopular government or, you know, a weak, shaky government while an insurgency is still raging around you. And so trust me, this is giving nightmares to the people in Washington, but they've set their first foot on that slope now, and they're going to find it much more difficult to resist than maybe they expect.
Were you surprised that the Iraqi army was so weak, and was this another case of a U.S. intelligence failure?
Everybody was shocked by that, I think. You know, it's not that ISIS was so strong, it's that the Iraqi army simply disintegrated. And now, in retrospect, you can see this and understand the reasons for it. The way Maliki was ruling Iraq was based on sectarianism and patronage and corruption. And it was clear that these units had very low morale, very poor training, very poor leadership. And so, you know, in retrospect, it's easy to understand why they collapsed. But I don't think anybody anticipated it at the time. And that's why the idea of ISIS seizing Mosul simply seemed crazy. No one even really considered it. But now here we are. It does really, though, raise a lot of questions, though. We talk about training a moderate rebel army, and, you know, we spent years and billions of dollars
yeah.
training the Iraqi army, and this is the best they can
and
do.
What we're seeing is our tanks being destroyed.
Or being used by ISIS against us.
You know, a question that our listeners have heard me often ask is, could we, and what difference would it have made if U.S. troops had stayed in Iraq? I mean, we've heard that President Obama really wanted to be able to say that he was successful and the troops were under his watch were withdrawn, or that Iran put pressure on the Prime Minister Maliki not to let the U.S. troops. What's your view there?
I don't think it would have made much difference, to be honest. So by the time you get to the decision to withdraw American troops, you were already well down the road. So the United States had actually stopped doing combat missions, and they were basically restricted to their bases. They weren't policing the streets of Baghdad anymore. What was being envisioned, you know, towards the end of the negotiations was a very small advisory force, somewhere between 2,000 and 20,000, which is, you know, that's a lot. That's more than we have now. But it probably would not have really bought a great deal of extra security. You know, we might have, you know, had a few more people there as an early warning.
Yeah.
But they would also have been caught up in these nasty Iraqi politics.
And we probably would have had to escalate.
Yeah, and they would have been a political issue.
We have about another minute or two, and you know, we're both in Norfolk, Virginia today, where you're going to be speaking on a program supported by the World Affairs Councils of America. But I remember well when you came to Dallas-Fort Worth, and you were somewhat optimistic about what we were seeing from the Arab Spring. What's your view today?
Well, you know, at that moment, we were clearly at a crossroads where you could imagine things going well, and I was really trying to maintain hope at that time. But you could also easily see how everything was going to go wrong, and you needed to get some things to go right. You needed some breaks along the way. And unfortunately, everything is broken in the wrong direction, and then it feeds upon itself. So Egypt's revolution ends in a military coup and fierce repression. This then has spin-off effects around the rest of the region as people then, you know, go that authoritarian route. In the entire Arab Spring, only Tunisia has really accomplished anything resembling a transition to democracy, and that's still a very fragile, very tenuous problem.
With elections to come.
The elections are about to come up, and then you have these really failed states that are just dragging everything down. So everybody looks at Syria and how that's dragging everyone, its neighbors down, but even like the failed state in Libya is destabilizing Egypt, destabilizing Tunisia, creating an open arms market, and exporting radicals. Failed state in Yemen is destabilizing the south of the Arabian Peninsula. So, in a sense, there was a chance for things to go right, but they've pretty much gone as badly as they could have possibly gone at this point.
Mark, tell our listeners and members where they can follow your writings.
Well, I write for the Monkey Cage blog. It's a political science blog on the Washington Post. And I also run something called POMEPS, the Project on Middle East Political Science, where more academic pieces get published. So you can find me in either of those. And I've also reopened my blog, Abu Aardvark.
Good,
2 weeks ago, abuaardvark.typepad.com.
That's why I started receiving it again. All right. Well, thanks so much, Mark, for joining us on Global IQ Minute.
Well, thank you.
It's great to be in Norfolk with you.